Alrighty, you're listening to 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Joseph Davis. I have on the line with me today Dr. Guy McPherson, one of the leading voices in talking about climate change today. And Doctor, it's good to have you with us from your mud hut out there in New Mexico, as I understand it.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity, Joseph. I appreciate it.
Yes, you do have a podcast that I would like to make people aware of. It is called Nature Bats Last, and where can people listen to that, please?
Well, along with Mike Sleva, we broadcast every Tuesday afternoon, 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network, and the show is archived either at the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, or there's a Podbean, naturebatslast.podbean.com, and it's on Stitcher and iTunes as well. So you can find it any number of places under the moniker Nature Bats Last.
Excellent. I just wanted to make people aware that there are various ways that we can get in, that they can listen to the show with you and your friend Mike Sleva. The reason I wanted to have you on, Doctor, is that I've been following your work and on social media for a while, and maybe it's just me, but I felt my fellow listeners here in Kansas City should be aware of what you have been talking about and what you have been saying. First of all, if you could give a little background as to how you came to study climate change. You are a professor emeritus, as I understand it, from, I want to say, Arizona, the University of Arizona. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I'm professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. I was teaching and conducting research there between 1989 and 2009. I became emeritus professor in 2009. So a little over 7 years ago, I left active service at the university.
And you come by climatology and abrupt climate change. Let's just go ahead and call it for what it is. Most of your colleagues, as I understand it, are either physicists or climatologist. You come through it through a different way. How is that?
Yeah, I'm a conservation biologist. The field, the discipline of conservation biology, didn't even exist until a little after I completed my PhD in range science at Texas Tech University. So I have a bachelor's degree in forestry, or how to cut down every tree on the planet,
then
master's and PhDs in range science, which is sort of the livestock grazing equivalent of forest management. It's all about command and control and financializing, commodifying every living thing on the planet in support of human beings. So ultimately, I came to view myself more as a conservation biologist than a natural resource management person or a natural resource ecologist. That's a lot different than the perspective of most people who call themselves climate scientists. Their degrees typically are in physics, astronomy, engineering, and so on. Consider, for example, James Hansen, probably the best-known climate scientist in the world, certainly in the United States. He has degrees in astronomy and physics, I believe.
Correct.
So these are not disciplines that are steeped in biology and ecology, and therefore they don't have the kind of biological perspective and ecological perspective that I have. I am well acquainted with the notions of speciation, extinction, and especially habitat. And those are sort of the three pillars on which conservation biology is founded. How do species go extinct? How do they come into being? And what is the habitat necessary to support their persistence on the planet? So I come at the notion of human extinction from the perspective of habitat, influenced by my background in teaching and conducting research on habitat and speciation and extinction events.
I see. That leads me to my first question, because we as, you know, a human collective, for want of a better term, we are experiencing a decline in habitat. As I understand it, and some years ago, Bruce Coburn had a song where he talks about, you know, a rate of a species every single day that has increased exponentially. How does that impact our habitat as a human family?
Yeah, well, certainly habitat for humans is going away in many places around the globe. Consider, for example, the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific, five of which disappeared within the last few years.
I beg your
under
pardon?
Under rising sea level.
Wow.
There's extinction of a mammal species on that set of islands as well. It's completely gone. Extinction means no remaining individuals of the species. There is habitat for humans quickly disappearing in the Middle East and Northern Africa. And some people refer to this as a migration crisis.
Thank you very much. I wanted for you to specify the difference between migration and refugees. And you're there.
Right.
Thank you.
So these people are not migrating. They're not moving to one place for a certain part of the year and then moving back to the Middle East and Northern Africa for another part of the year. So that's the definition of migration. You know, we hear a lot about migratory birds, for example, that come from Alaska or Canada and come down to the southwest United States or even further, go down into the tropics during the winter, and then they migrate back in the summer back up north. Well, these people who are leaving the Middle East and Northern Africa, the people who are leaving the islands in the South Pacific, because they're losing habitat, they're migrants. They're not going to go away for 6 months and come back. They're not going on some sort of vacation. They're actually refugees. They're fleeing areas that no longer have habitat to support them. So it's a very subtle but distinct difference that most of the mainstream media seems to be unable of detecting, that subtle but significant difference. It's a hugely important matter. The people who have left the Solomon Islands that are now underwater are not migrants. They're refugees.
Understood. I decided for this interview, sir, to take kind of a C-SPAN approach. So I'm going to, you know, and by the way, you're tuned into 90.1 FM, KKFI, and I'm Joseph Davis, and I have the pleasure of to be on the line with Guy McPherson, one of the leading voices talking about abrupt climate change. I'm going to take kind of the C-SPAN approach, if you will, Doctor. I just saw something about the environmental activist Tim DeChristopher, and he talked about this era on a video. In fact, I think it was on Democracy Now! This morning. My friend Mike is nodding. He's calling this the age of anticipatory mass graves. Now, in your experience as a teacher, an activist, and it also should be known as a grief counselor, sir, what are you seeing and hearing as individuals come to terms on a very intimate and personal level with the concept of near-term human extinction?
Well, as you might imagine, it varies considerably. There's a lot of denial. You know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is fairly well known for her five stages of grief, and the first of those is denial. She pointed out that a person doesn't move from one stage to the other in some sort of textbook fashion or ratcheting fashion and then never go back. Rather, she pointed out that this is a complex set of emotions we feel, and at any point, some of us might be in denial and be angry and also be bargaining. So she recognized these, quote, stages as having relatively fluid transitions, and we don't necessarily, once we leave a stage, we don't necessarily never go back there. But what I'm seeing, to to take a simplified approach to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Grief, what I'm seeing is people who are spending a lot of time in denial that climate change is even anthropogenic in origin. And I'm stunned that I'm still seeing that. I guess I shouldn't be, given my relatively long history of interacting with people who are perfectly capable of denying almost any scientific fact. But still, it surprises me, the lack of reason, the lack of rational thinking when it comes to denying anthropogenic climate change. It sort of drives me a little crazy that people are still denying abrupt climate change, which is a phenomenon that has precedence in Earth's history and that pretty clearly we're in the midst of right now. Consider, for example, through the first 265 years of the Industrial Revolution, from 1750 until September of 2015, the global average temperature of the planet increased by about 1 degree Celsius, about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
Uh-huh.
And then in the next 4 months, global average temperature rose another 0.57 degrees Celsius, nearly one more degree Fahrenheit.
My goodness.
That's in 4 months as compared to the first 265 years of the Industrial Revolution. So it's pretty clear to me that we're in the midst of abrupt climate change, but for a lot of people, there's still a lot of denial and anger, like, who could get us into this mess? It must be somebody else's fault. I have children. I have grandchildren. This can't be happening, that sort of thing. And then, of course, there's bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we come on to topics like, if we just do fill in the blank, we'll be fine. We'll be able to fix this. Well, we're in the midst of irreversible abrupt climate change. There's no fixing this. It's a predicament. It's not a problem that has some sort of solution. We can't switch to solar panels and expect to solve this predicament. And I say that from the perspective of somebody who, along with my wife, helped create a platinum-grade homestead in southern New Mexico that has a 3.15 kilowatt solar array on the roof and is off-grid with an extensive battery bank and with an enormous orchard and big gardens and that sort of thing. So I did my own bargaining. You know, I tried to negotiate my way out of this situation, and I came to recognize that it didn't work for me. It's not going to work for us as a society either. And instead, I'm trying to, with dispersal of information and establishment of some sort of relationship with people that will allow them emotionally and psychologically to come to grips with where we're at, and trying to suggest that we can move beyond denial and anger and bargaining and even depression and get into the notion of acceptance. It's pretty obvious to everybody that they are going to die as an individual.
Right.
And it's not that big a stretch to say that in a relatively short period of time, since our lives are so short, that everybody is going to die and that there will be no habitat for our species. You know, every single species that has arisen on the planet has gone extinct, except for the relatively few that are here now. That's about somewhere in the neighborhood of 1% or maybe less, maybe fewer than 1% of all the species that have ever occupied the planet are extant today, are persisting today.
Wow.
So there's an extensive body of evidence indicating that extinctions happen to every species so far, except for the few that are still hanging around. There's an extensive body of evidence indicating that industrial civilization is driving to extinction a huge number of species every day, according to the United Nations in a report put out in August of 2010, so now coming up on 6 years ago, we drive to extinction 150 to 200 species per day. So it shouldn't come as a big surprise, then, that we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction on Earth, as concluded in a paper in Science Advances from about a year ago, and that, of course, our species is going to go the way of other species in the midst of a mass extinction event. It doesn't really matter how clever we are, how willing we are to negotiate. Like all other species, when we change our own habitat, when we foul our own nest, we can't expect to hang around forever in light of those kinds of actions.
I see. You just mentioned industrial civilization, and you also talk about the notion of a heat engine, and I think my next two questions are kind of, I'm going to let you unpack them. I'm just going to ask them. How is industrial civilization, this civilization that we're in that is rather predatory, how is it a heat engine? And what would happen right now? I snapped my fingers just now. Industrial revolution just stopped. What would happen?
Yeah, those are great questions. Based on Tim Garrett's work, Tim is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah, and his first paper on the topic was published originally in 2009, but then there was a horrific outcry from the scientific community, and so based strictly on politics, the paper was delayed in coming out in print form until February 2011, and he's published at least two papers since then indicating that civilization itself is a heat engine. And after I quoted Garrett in a few presentations and in some of my writing, people wrote to me and said that I didn't understand what he was talking about, that he didn't mean industrial civilization would collapse and that's the only thing that would prevent runaway climate change, because that's too horrible a thought to contemplate. So you need to get this clear, they said. So I wrote to Dr. Garrett and asked him what he meant, and he meant what I thought he meant. Industrial civilization, to turn off that switch, means that there's no longer any fuel at the filling stations, no food at the grocery store, no water coming out of the municipal taps. It means game over for all of the privileges we currently enjoy, for those of us within this set of living arrangements. And we use all kinds of terms to describe it, and the terminology seems to get in the way. Because, of course, almost everybody thinks of civilization as a good thing, for those who even question it, for those who even contemplate what that might mean. But in fact, it has its downsides. Other versions of civilization, this one is also destroying habitat for other species to support human population overshoot. And that has happened many times in the past, albeit only regionally. This time, it's global. In the past, civilizations have persisted until they went into regional human population overshoot, at which point their populations completely collapsed. In some cases, essentially every member of that particular community died, and the few survivors moved on and became part of other bands or tribes, became part of other societies in any event. In a few cases, the survivors came back to the same area they'd been living before and where they'd seen their civilization collapse. And they made a choice. We're not doing that anymore. We're not creating civilization. And here when I talk about civilization, it's not industrial civilization. It's civilization based on grains, based on the ability to store grains, to store food. And this is emblematic of every civilization, including ours, including industrial civilization. The civilization persists because we're able to grow grains and store those grains and therefore get through the winter, you know, when we don't have food growing. And in many cases, get through many winters because crops fail. Because we're in human population overshoot, so we need more and more food for more and more people. And, of course, that becomes its own self-reinforcing feedback loop. So some of the obvious disadvantages of civilization, of any civilization, are human population overshoot. Currently, there's more than 200,000 people added to the planet every day. That's births minus
death.
Could
you repeat that? 200,000 people, is that including births and deaths?
Yes, so that's births minus deaths. So oh, wow. The number of births is somewhere around 300 and some thousand per day of humans, and the number of deaths is only around 100,000 or so. So we're adding 200 and some thousand people a day to the planet. The last figures I saw were somewhere between 207,000 and 216,000, but of course it varies from month to month and from year to year, depending on specific fertility rates and so on. So that's one of the outcomes of civilization is population overshoot, human population overshoot. And then there are others. You know, anytime you grow grains or any other staple crops at scale, you're degrading the landscape. In our case, we're washing soil into the ocean at an accelerating rate. Mm. We're fouling the air and dirtying the water. And those are characteristics of every civilization, not just this one. Anytime you turn a plow, you're kicking greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere. Even if you use a horse to pull the plow, there's still a lot of carbon in the soil that is being converted into gaseous form, mm-hmm. and therefore ending up in the atmosphere and serving as a heat blanket. And that's why civilization is a heat engine, mm-hmm. because those greenhouse gases are put up into the atmosphere, and they serve as blankets, holding down the heat closer to the planet, stacking on more and more blankets on a hot summer day. The hotter it gets, the more we turn up the air conditioners, and therefore put greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere, and therefore add to the heating effect, the blankets that cover us all. So it's every version of civilization that produces these greenhouse gases. It's just that this version of civilization, industrial civilization, is the one that is completely reliant upon fossil fuels to be maintained, and therefore that's contributing more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere along with other greenhouse gases than any other version of civilization that persisted before ours.
I see.
So it's a mess.
Yeah.
And that's where the heat engine comes from. Even if we were to turn off the switch today, there's about a 10-year lag between emission of carbon dioxide and maximum heating associated with that particular molecule or that particular bunch of carbon dioxide.
Wow.
Also, we have triggered a sufficient number of self-reinforcing feedback loops, or so-called positive feedbacks. They aren't so positive from our perspective, that even if we stop today, the snowball keeps rolling down the hill. The horse has already escaped from the barn door, and shutting the door today doesn't mean we're going to stop the horse. In addition, there's a phenomenon called global dimming. The first papers I'm aware of that appeared in the Referee Journal literature came out in late 2011. The first one that I'm aware of was by James Hansen and colleagues. And so this is after Tim Garrett's work at the University of Utah indicating that civilization is a heat engine. And in that first paper, Hansen and colleagues found that...
Doctor, I want to interrupt and let people know that they are listening to you, Dr. Guy McPherson, on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Missouri. Doctor, please continue.
Thank you, Joseph. I'm sorry.
you've got it. You've got it down. Please continue, sir.
So what that paper by Hansen and colleagues found in late 2011 was that there's this concept called global dimming. In addition to putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, industrial civilization also puts up other particulates. So in the process of industrial activity and in running our computers and driving our cars and keeping the coal-fired power plants going and so on, that has interestingly paradoxical impacts. Not only is carbon dioxide and methane and chlorofluorocarbon and ozone, not only are those produced, and those are greenhouse gases that serve as a heat blanket, but there are also particulates, most notably aerosols and sulfates, associated with burning poor quality coal that are put up into the atmosphere. And what those particulates do is serve as an umbrella over the atmosphere of the Earth. They're pretty high up in the atmosphere, and incoming solar radiation, some of it gets bounced back up into space. So
wow.
if we were to stop industrial activity today, we would still be dealing with the 10-year lag in carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. We would still be dealing with those myriad self-reinforcing feedback loops, such as melting of the permafrost producing methane, such as an open ocean in the Arctic, an ice-free Arctic.
Yes, that's the one. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but the one that kind, there are two of them that kind of, you know, and I'm no scientist, and you know, but the one that scares me, just from following this, and is the notion of a blue sea event. If you could talk about a blue sea event for our listeners.
Yeah, and so I'll get to that in just a second.
Okay.
I just want to wrap up the notion of this global dimming.
Okay.
Because if we stop producing industrial activity today, and I'll keep this short, then all those particulates fall out of the sky in as little as 3 days or so, and we experience a very, very abrupt warming of the planet. As a result, it's like taking down the umbrella, but the sunshine keeps coming in.
Okay.
In fact, we took down the umbrella, so more sunshine is hitting us now. So the heating of the planet could be up to 3 degrees Celsius, or about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, in a matter of a few days. So that's a global average. That's a huge deal.
Mm.
So there are untoward effects at this point, whether we stop or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's truly horrifying that we have created this set of conditions. Now, on to the ice-free Arctic or the Blue Ocean event. The U.S. Naval Postgraduate College did a study several years ago in which they predicted an ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. And it certainly looks like that could happen this year. I'm not making that prediction. The U.S. Naval Postgraduate College did, plus or minus 3 years. I'd say we dodged a bullet each of the last 3 years.
Hardly a bastion of liberalism.
That hasn't happened.
Yeah.
In the history of our genus, Homo, on the planet. So an ice-free Arctic means a rapid acceleration of methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean and being kicked up into the atmosphere. It means a loss of albedo or reflectance from the ice and a sudden rapid heating of the ocean as well. So you think things are wacky now with respect to the climate and the ensuing weather. We can only imagine what it's going to look like when we really start kicking the methane up to the atmosphere, when we really start warming the Arctic and the Arctic Ocean, and therefore all the other oceans on the planet. You think we've seen craziness with the polar vortex, with the meandering jet stream mm-hmm. now. Just imagine when there's no ice cap, when there's no air conditioner for the planet up there in the Arctic.
Oh my.
And at this point, we can only imagine because it hasn't happened before.
Oh, my goodness. I want to talk about a gun that the NRA and Gun Lovers of America know nothing about, and that's the clathrate gun. What is it, and how is it manifesting itself in relation to anthropogenic climate change?
Yeah, the clathrate gun was the gun that James Hansen was particularly worried about in his 2007 book, Storms Over My Grandchildren. And it appears that's the year, 2007, the year the book came out, it appears that's the year that the clathrate gun was fired. Clathrates, sometimes called hydrates, are chemical cages around methane molecules. Methane is CH4.
Mm-hmm.
We commonly know it as natural gas that we use to heat our homes or to heat the water in our homes. So CH4, that molecule, is bound within a chemical cage called a clathrate or a hydrate. And with a little bit of warming, the clathrate breaks open and the methane molecule is released into the water, into the water column in the case of the Arctic Ocean, if the clathrate is on the shallow sea floor, as many of them are, or directly into the atmosphere in the case of permafrost in, for example, Canada, Alaska, or Siberia. So we get a little bit of warming in the permafrost. The permafrost starts to degrade and the CH4 or methane is released directly into the atmosphere. Same thing happens from the seafloor when the chemical cages holding CH4 or methane are broken open, and those chemical cages are called clathrate. And it appears that the clathrate gun was fired in 2007. Tracking back to then, it's pretty obvious that we have triggered, or that we have seen triggered, the exponential rise in methane in the atmosphere. And that has, at a larger time scale, that exponential rise has been going on since 1750, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But it's particularly obvious after a pause from about the year 2000 to 2007, it's particularly obvious that it started again, an exponential rise, in about 2007. I haven't seen a decent explanation for why there was that pause between about 2000 and 2007, but it also applied to carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So there's the two major greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that serve as blankets, that serve to hold the heat down close to the planet, and their exponential rise in the atmosphere was interrupted for about 7 years or so between after 2000, the year 2000, and then they skyrocketed again in 2007 or so. Methane is particularly worrisome because it's at least 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is. So we hear a lot about carbon dioxide and how we need to reduce emissions and so forth, but molecule for molecule, methane in the atmosphere, CH4 in the atmosphere, is at least 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas in terms of heating as carbon dioxide is.
So Aliso Canyon, that recent event that went on for over 30 days, that didn't help us at all.
No, absolutely not, and it's hardly an isolated event either.
I beg your pardon?
Those kinds of things are popping up all over the place now, and tack onto that animal agriculture, industrial animal agriculture accounts for somewhere in the vicinity of 30% of total methane release into the atmosphere, because those pigs and cows aren't just sitting around eating. They also conduct various other bodily activities mm-hmm. during their lives, just like humans do.
Yeah.
They release methane into the atmosphere.
I see. I want to kind of get away from the science and by the way, I'm Joseph Davis, and I'm talking with climate scientist Dr. Guy McPherson, who has a show, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network and other outlets on the internet. He co-hosts a show with his friend Mike Sliva. And you are listening to 90.1 FM. And I wanted to ask you, doctors, because we're past the 30-minute mark, and I wanted to ask you about a woman that you've had on your show as a frequent guest, Corey Morningstar, who maintains a website, Wrong Kind of Green. Discuss what you've learned in your conversations with her, you and Mike.
Yeah, Corey Morningstar is an outstanding independent journalist. She lives in Ontario, Canada, and I interviewed her relatively early on in the course of the show. And then within 6 or 8 months, she became a frequent contributor to the show. And I interviewed her because I was already learning so much from her. For example, the first place I read that 2 degrees Celsius was a political target, not a scientific target. First place I read that was from Corey Morningstar's work. And she was pointing out that the real target, the scientific target, was established by the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October of 1990, when they said 1 degree Celsius is the absolute upper limit beyond which we cannot cross, or we will trigger the kinds of self-reinforcing feedback loops that James Hansen was worried about in his 2007 book, Storms My Grandchildren. And sure enough, it didn't take until even one part per million before we triggered a whole bunch of those self-reinforcing feedback loops, including the firing of the clathrate gun. And so David Spratt, climate speaker and writer, pointed out think it was in 2014 in a presentation, that probably a half a degree Celsius was a more appropriate target in terms of stopping those self-reinforcing feedback loops from getting underway. And here he's talking about a half a degree Celsius or approximately 1 degree Fahrenheit above the 1750 baseline, above the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So Corey Morningstar is an outstanding researcher who is just unbelievably thorough in her approach. And she puts together this information and then puts it out voluminously.
Yes, that I agree. Oh my goodness. I would even, if I could interject here, Doctor, I would say, in addition to your website, Nature Bats Last, which can be Googled, or GuyMcPherson.com, I would highly suggest our listeners go to WrongKindOfGreen.org, because I think your two websites in tandem can really help our listeners and the public in general, the public that does care about this very sensitive and grave issue confronting humankind. I think the two can serve as not only a resource, but as some kind of comfort. And so please continue.
No, that's great. I mean, I can't join you enough. I can't reinforce strongly enough that following Corey's work is an excellent idea. She just really, really digs deep, gets to the root of the issue, and by the way, has absolutely no incentive for doing so. She has children, some grown, some living at home. You know, she doesn't want to know, much less experience, much less have her children experience the kind of horrors that she writes about. But she writes about them, the ones that are already underway, the many downsides of imperialism. And she also writes about what's likely to come in an incredibly thorough manner. So I join you in endorsing and recommending her work to others at Wrong Kind of Green. And also she writes at Art of Annihilation and a few other places. And when I last checked, her series on divestment was up to 15 parts.
Oh,
and
wow.
Each of them is several thousand words and incredibly well-documented, thoroughly credited in terms of who said what and when and who wrote what and when and putting together scientific information. And this is from somebody, bear in mind, who doesn't have a PhD in the sciences, doesn't have a PhD at all. She's just a rational human being capable of synthesizing, organizing, integrating, and coming to conclusions based upon reason, which admittedly is a rare attribute in our society.
I think
the kind of thing that just about anybody could be able to accomplish with some effort.
I think that's one of the reasons why I personally wanted to conduct this conversation with you, because, you know, there does come a point where there is, you know, you accept it as a rational human being, but then you also want to do something. And then you want to also, there's a sense of purpose, a sense of relief. Which leads me to my next question. You talked about your experience with young people, which I can't remember which California presentation you did, but what is your experience with young people in particular after one of your presentations? How are people of color like myself, how are they responding? The gay community, the indigenous and First Nations community. When these people hear what you have to say about near-term human extinction and abrupt climate change, does it trigger in them a sense of purpose, resistance, joy?
I see all of the above, and especially among the demographics you mentioned. And I think there's a reason for that. People who don't look a lot like me, who are not white men in what is a society that rewards that demographic. So people who don't look like me, people who look like you, people who are younger than me, people who are indigenous, people often who are women, know what it's like to be on the wrong side of oppression. And that oppression need not come in physical form. It can come psychologically and emotionally as well. And so these are the people who, in my experience anyway, understand and take in my message about near-term human extinction most rapidly and most readily. When I hear from, you mentioned the youngsters, and here I'm thinking college age individuals, people who are 20 years old,
yeah,
plus or minus, you know, 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Frequently what I hear from people in that age group is, well, yeah, of course. I feel as if I've been lied to my entire life, that the people pulling the strings of empire, including the media and the governments, aren't telling us the whole story. And you just told us the worst news of all. Of course that's got to be right, because nobody else is willing to tell, and they actually feel liberated by that.
You actually, I think, told, and this was moving to me, I had to kind of sit with it, an individual after one of your presentations actually skipped around the room. Is that correct?
That's right. There were two of them. So these are people between the ages of 18 and 22, and in the presentation hall, they actually skipped as if they were, 7 or 8 years old again, skipping like youngsters around the presentation hall, feeling that they were liberated by the information. And, you know, one of the responses, one of the outcomes to this information is a feeling of liberation from the shackles of culture.
Exactly.
We're told in this culture that we're to go to school, we're to get a job, we're to get married, we're to have children, we're to buy a house, we're to work until we're 60 or 65 or 70 years old, often at the same job or at least in the same field, and then we're to retire. And the cycle will go on indefinitely, presumably forever, with no significant change.
Right, and I think it's the indefinite.
Some people don't actually buy that, and some people are not actually benefiting from the system the way it is structured right now. And so when they hear and understand that they don't have to play that game, that the game is actually a lie, they feel liberated from the shackles of culture, and they're going to do something different. They're not going to go to school and get the job and be indebted for the rest of their lives. They're going to do something that makes their lives worth living.
I see.
That sounds great to me.
Exactly. Well, I think we're probably at that point where we should close. Doctor, we are I'm talking with Dr. Guy McPherson, one of the leading voices in climate science and abrupt climate change. You're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM. I want to take the time to thank my good friend Mike Murphy for guiding me through this process. Finally, Dr. Guy McPherson, as we wrap this up, I want to ask you something that's kind of personal and professional. What role, especially because you had on your program last, when I listened to Nature Bats last, you had Scott Dickers from The Onion on. But I want to talk, I want you to talk about the role of humor and empathy and camaraderie in your work with you and Mike and Forrest Palmer and T.R. McKenzie. I mean, there's joy there. And we all, and Kevin Hester out of New Zealand is just, he's really funny. But
right.
If you can talk about this sense of almost catharsis, because we're all kind of networked on Facebook and that kind of thing, and if you could share some of that, and if you could talk about the headline of your page. If anybody were to go to GuyMcPherson.com, talk about the headline and then these roles of humor, empathy, and camaraderie as we close.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Scott Dickers was the perfect guest, the founder and longest-serving editor-in-chief of The Onion. He's been doing that for a quarter of a century, and he came across my work, and he says, well, yeah, of course. You know, it's just sort of human behavior, at least civilized human behavior. And he was able to distinguish between indigenous groups, pre-civilized societies, and the societies structured around civilization. So he said, of course, yeah, you know, it's no great step to get there. And he uses humor, as The Onion basically always has, to point out the absurdities of society. And I think that's an important role, a profound role for social critics throughout history. I think of George Carlin and Bill Hicks and Louis C.K. and Doug Stanhope as being among the best social critics that were and are out there. They're just putting a lens on society, or sometimes putting a mirror up to our faces and pointing out the absurdity of what we do. And then, of course, pointing out that if you keep doing this, you're going to end up where you're headed. and it's ugly. And so, of course, we laugh in self-defense. The tagline at Nature Bats Last is, our days are numbered. Passionately pursue a life of excellence. And no matter how you look at it, our days are numbered. You know, most people, I think the median length of life for a human being on the planet is about 30,000 days. 30,000 days, that's not a lot.
No, and actually, I'm thinking of the old Moody Blues song, 22,000 days. on the old, go ahead.
Right. Yeah. And so, no matter how you look at it, even if you live nearly twice that long, it's not a long time. And each day seems to go by so quickly. And so, I guess what I'm trying to suggest is a sense of urgency, while also indicating that the use of humor, even if it's gallows humor, is imperative for me to get through the absurdity of civilized human life in these times. And it might be helpful for other people as well. Even if it's not, pursuing life with urgency doesn't seem like such a bad idea to me, because, in fact, our days are numbered, no matter how many of them we have.
Dr. Guy McPherson, it has been an honor and a privilege to have a conversation with you and to share it with my friend here, Mike Murphy, and to share it with this city that I love, Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. All the best to Mike and everybody in the so-called doomer community.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Joseph. It's a pleasure to chat with you today. I appreciate the opportunity.